For the media in the room, I would offer our usual disclaimer that the speaker's views do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Institute of Peace, which does not advocate specific policies. This event is being recorded live and will be available later from the USIP website. I'd ask you all please to turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices. The recording technology is very sensitive to having those even on, so putting them on silent vibrate is not really sufficient. It will interfere with the recording system. And finally, I'd like to turn over the program to today's moderator, Daryl Kimball, who's the Executive Director of the Arms Control Association. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much to the U.S. Institute for Peace and my colleagues at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, and especially to Avner Cohen for their work in pulling this event together today. My name is Daryl Kimball. I'm the Executive Director of the Arms Control Association. We're a nonpartisan organization dedicated to providing information and analysis about weapons-related security issues. And today we have several expert speakers to discuss the very significant and troubling set of events relating to Syria's likely effort to build a nuclear reactor at a site named Al-Kibar and Israel's September 6, 2007 raid on that site. I'm going to provide a little bit of context and provide some questions for discussion that our speakers are going to be addressing through the course of the morning, and then we're going to be going to questions from the audience. There are a lot of different issues related to this issue, and we've tried to provide a range of perspectives and information to cover the different facets. As you'll recall, in the immediate aftermath of the raid back in September 2007, there was very little information available about what was struck and why. Independent analysts, including one of them sitting here with us today, using satellite photographs, provided some of the first clues that the site may have been a nuclear installation under construction. But it was not until about 7 months later, that after the raid, that senior U.S. government officials reported to Congress and the United States news media that the U.S. intelligence community believes the facility was a small graphite-moderated reactor under construction that was nearly completed, according to the analysis. U.S. intelligence assessed that it was for military purposes and may have been constructed with the assistance of North Korea. With that information and perhaps other information, the International Atomic Energy Agency is now investigating what nuclear-related facilities may have been under construction at Al-Kibar and other sites elsewhere in Syria. Yet when we were discussing this in the nonproliferation community in the weeks afterwards, we found it quite surprising and a bit troubling that this dramatic series of events involving two longtime Middle Eastern adversaries and an alleged secret nuclear weapons program has prompted so little discussion and so little international reaction. So with the help of this panel, we're going to try to explore some of the issues that we think are very relevant for this situation, even now, several months after the raid, and even now after the IAEA has begun an investigation. So some of the questions that I think are very important that we'll address, I'm sure there'll be others that the speakers are going to be looking at. First of all, based on the publicly available information, was Syria actually constructing a reactor for a military program? How far along was that project? Did the facility pose an imminent security threat to its neighbors? What legal basis, if any, did Israel have for attacking the facility? Does the almost non-existent criticism of Israel's raid on the site reflect a shift in international opinion about the use of preventive force, or is that more of a reflection of the fact that there was a lack of information about the facility and its purpose? What can we expect the International Atomic Energy Agency to uncover now, months after the raid, and after Syria has cleared the remains of the buildings that were at the Al-Kibar site? What are the implications of Syria's alleged nuclear activities for the IAEA safeguards regime and the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty itself? Syria is a member of the NPT. Does this represent a vote of no confidence in the safeguard system and the United Nations itself? And has the International Atomic Energy Agency responded to this incident properly? How might the incident affect the debate about Iran's nuclear program? Some of our speakers are going to explore that today. How might the incident impede or perhaps encourage efforts to realize a Middle Eastern zone free of weapons of mass destruction? You should note that just yesterday, the founding statement of the Mediterranean Forum, I believe it's called, more than 40 nations, including Israel and Syria, agreed to pursue a mutually and effectively verifiable Middle East zone free of weapons of mass destruction. Now, that's been mentioned many times in the international context, but this is just the most recent occasion, and it's the first occasion since the raid on Al-Khobar. And then another question is, why didn't Israel and the United States report their findings about Al-Khobar to the IAEA or the UN Security Council? And on this point, let me just offer a personal comment before I go to the introductions of the speakers. I mean, in my view, rather than striking first and making assertions later, Israel and or the United States ought to have presented their evidence to the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Governors or the Security Council. The IAEA investigation that would have followed at that point, in the absence of a raid, could have been far more effective in revealing the true nature of the facility and the sources of assistance. Again, remember, there are accusations about assistance to Syria in building this reactor and perhaps other nuclear facilities. Utilizing the agency to draw attention to serious safeguards violations, and this would have been, is a safeguards violation, would have strengthened the credibility of the agency, put Syria on the defensive, and led Syria to shut down its secret nuclear program. And it would reinforce the agency and the UN system at a very crucial time in the debate about the Iranian nuclear program. So these are just some of the issues that we're going to explore today. To address them, we've got some of the best experts on the Middle East, on nuclear weapons issues, and this particular incident. First, we're going to hear from David Albright, who is president of the Institute for Science and International Security and one of the world's top independent nuclear nonproliferation analysts. Then we're going to go down the table. We're going to hear from Avner Cohen, who, as you heard, is currently a senior fellow here at USIP, and he's authored numerous articles on nuclear security issues and the Middle East, including, of course, his seminal 1998 book, Israel and the Bomb. We'll hear from Leonard Spector, known to some of us as Sandy, who's deputy director of the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He's the center's Washington, D.C. office director, and I would add that both of them have together written a fine piece, a thoughtful piece in this month's issue of Arms Control Today that's available on the table outside. That's my organization's journal. And we'll hear from Robin Wright, who's one of the nation's top foreign affairs journalists and authors. She's written for the Washington Post, of course, the Los Angeles Times, other books, including her recent book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, which is already out, right? Okay, so I'll remember that. And then we'll hear from Fiona Simpson, who's currently at the Center for International Cooperation at New York University. Dr. Simpson's worked at the Weapons of Mass Destruction branch at the UN Department of Disarmament Affairs, and she's worked at in Vienna with the External Relations and Policy Division at the IAEA. And then last but not least, we'll hear from Ambassador Tom Graham, who many of you know, who's been associated with and has worked on virtually all of the major nonproliferation arms control agreements that as a member of the United States government. He most notably, for this discussion, was one of the key individuals in the extension of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in 1995. He's going to be speaking about some of the legal aspects and the implications for the NPT regime. So with that, I would ask David to come to the podium and offer us your thoughts about what we know, what we don't know about Al-Khobar.
Okay. Thank you, Daryl. No, I'm happy to be here today. There's a lot of questions that Daryl laid out, and this Al-Kabar issue is very complicated. What I'd like to do is just kind of go through almost a series of bullets. And I'd particularly like to focus on some of the uncertainties facing us on this issue. And I also want to start that this has been a very almost strange issue, one of the strangest issues I've ever run into in nonproliferation, where the government has information, or certain governments have information, and it's made decisions to hold back that information. And the public, media, the NGOs are left to try to just figure out what's going on. And I think for us at ISIS, because there were suspicions about nuclear, we were immediately drawn into this, but found it overall almost bizarre, as I mentioned. I think at this point in time, I don't think there's any doubt that it was a reactor under construction. I mean, maybe someone can make that argument, maybe they could convince me, but I think from what I've seen, and I've seen quite a bit of the evidence, I think it's a reactor. I don't think we'll discuss it here, but there's interesting questions about what happened in the public debate. Why in the public debate we spent so much time discussing whether it was a reactor, and I would almost say that diverted us from a discussion of one of the questions Daryl raised, which is, should Israel have attacked that reactor? And I think by doing that, there wasn't any pressure brought to bear on Israel to face responsibility for what it did. And if you remember back in, well, maybe some of you will remember back in 1981, when the Osirik reactor was attacked, Israel was very forward on that. I was actually living in Israel when it happened. And it was a huge debate. And Israel immediately started to suffer international consequences, some quite severe for the time. And I assume someone else will talk about that. There are some very important questions, though, that remain unknown. And I think, again, in the public, we're not going to get the information. That I think there's a lot of interest in keeping the information out of the public domain by our government, the Israeli government. One of the most important was the reactor startup imminent? I mean, that was the U.S. intelligence argument, certainly Israel's worst-case estimate, and therefore it was going to start up, fuel was going to be put in, it would become radioactive, and you couldn't bomb it anymore. And so an attack was necessary at that time based on their logic. I would say we don't actually know was startup imminent. And it gets into this other assessment, which was the U.S. intelligence assessment, and it was stated by McConnell at the briefing that was given to journalists that there's low confidence in the judgment that Syria had a nuclear weapons program. And what does that mean? It doesn't mean there wasn't one there. It just means the evidence to show that was not there. For example, was there fuel for the reactor? Was North Korea going to sell the fuel to Syria? Let's say the first core load of fuel. Was Syria building a fuel fabrication plant in secret? These questions were not answered, certainly by the time of the bombing. Was there a reprocessing plant? If there's a nuclear weapons program, you've got to have a reprocessing plant to separate out the plutonium from the irradiated fuel. Again, no evidence of a facility. That one is less important because in the North Korean case, my memory is correct, the reactor started before construction of the reprocessing plant at Yongbyon began, or if it had started, it was extremely early phase of construction at Yongbyon. But nonetheless, if you want to accuse a country of having a nuclear weapons program, you should at least have some evidence, concrete evidence, and not speculation, that these other parts of the fuel cycle are in place. Same with uranium, at least the last time I checked. And again, some of this I haven't checked in a month or so. Uranium, it's not clear. Now, maybe they were going to get it from North Korea, but if they were going to build their own fuel fabrication plant, then uranium becomes a critical issue. How were they going to get it? Again, had they bought some in Africa, like many countries did many years ago, and had hidden it from the IAEA? Again, we don't know. So I think there are many questions that need to be answered about this situation. And that brings me to the International Atomic Energy Agency's role in this. And also, I'll touch upon some of the issues involving the credibility of the IAEA. Skip over that, was the attack necessary? I'd be happy to answer that if there's time, but I think many people will discuss that. I think it's unfair to criticize the IA on this. I mean, it's been clear to the IA and others who pay attention that if you don't have the additional protocol in force, this advanced safeguards method that was developed in the 1990s, it was developed in response to the failure of the IA in Iraq, the traditional safeguards just don't work to find undeclared nuclear activities if the state takes even minimal steps to hide those. And it was quite clear that if you didn't have it in place in Syria, the IA didn't have a chance. And it's not its fault. We knew that it also, in Libya, did not ratify or bring into force the additional protocol in order to hide its nuclear weapons program, which was buying from A.Q. Khan and his network. Iran deliberately ratchets up and down its cooperation with regard to the additional protocol. We're in a period now where there is no additional protocol. Very hard to know if there's undeclared facilities. And so I think a lesson of this is that safeguards cannot work without the additional protocol. And it's the failure of governments, largely, that do not insist that as a condition of nuclear supply, the additional protocol be in place. And we're very far from that now. The approach has been the additional protocol is voluntary. It's not required. And I would say that a lesson of the Syria case, as the lesson of Libya was, as the lesson of Iran was, is that the additional protocol should be insisted upon before any nuclear business is done with a non-nuclear weapons state party to the NPT. And I think in that, and I'll be happy to even add to that. To me, another, am I running out? How many?
Yeah,
oh, okay, there's plenty of time. Another lesson is that illicit nuclear trade is all present in these cases. We tend to not realize it, but these countries like Syria have to come someplace to buy a reactor component, reactor technology. If you go to Libya, they had to buy the entire nuclear weapons production complex from Pakistan's A.Q. Khan. If you look at Iran, extensive overseas procurement, mostly much of it illegal, that's ongoing. They still go out and buy the parts and equipment they need for their nuclear weapons program. Some of those things they buy are to try to be able to make it themselves. Some of the things are they just buy, and they look for loopholes and exploit the weaknesses of various export control arrangements. And they're masters at it, and they're usually one step ahead. And so in the case of Syria, you have another case where country cannot build the wherewithal to build nuclear weapons. It goes out and tries to buy it. Now, one of the twists in this is that we don't think it's a turnkey facility. It wasn't like Libya buying a gas centrifuge plant, lock, stock, and barrel. It looks like it was also Libya engaging in buying some components from North Korea, but also using North Korean or working with North Korean trading companies to buy equipment internationally for that reactor. And so, and quickly, the lesson is that it goes on and we're not paying enough attention to illicit nuclear trade. One of the blessings of this is the six-party talks were going on. And that essentially ended North Korea's cooperation with Syria on nuclear matters. Certainly the TAC did that, but also the six-party talks was a venue that could get a commitment from North Korea not to do it again. And so I want to also say that diplomacy in these cases can really work. And I would say that if this, based on what was going on in the six-party talks, it is a legitimate question to ask whether Syria could have ever finished that reactor if it hadn't gotten everything it needed from North Korea by last summer or the winter before that. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Avner?
Thank you, Daryl. Thank you, everybody. We have very few minutes, so we'll have a certain kind of division of labor that Sandy and I will do in presenting some of our thoughts. The discussion that led to the research and writing that led to the piece that Sandy and I wrote started with a simple sense of a puzzlement, political puzzlement, about the Israeli strike in Syria in early September. David just also referred to that sense of there is something quite bizarre. Simply put, In a certain sense, the event in Syria in 2000 was a kind of repeat of what Israel did in 1981. It was similar modus operandi. Actually, in 81 it was 8 F-16, this time it was 7. Similar kind of attitude of preemption or preventive, similar doctrine inspire both actions. And yet, at the same time, the political reaction to these two events were so radically different. To the paint, it was difference of day and night. Simply put, in 1991, the world condemned Israeli actions almost in its entirety. There was some ambivalence in the U.S., but by and large, the world was angry and accepted the Iraq claims of being attacked. And Israel was in defense. In 2007, the world essentially responded with a very loud silence. Loud silence because, given the rumors and given the attention, there was something so odd about that silence. While the silence made some sense, I think, initially, when really no authoritative information was around until April, the puzzle grew even larger when the CIA issued long video, I think it was 12 minutes or so, and then briefing, informal and formal, which essentially identified the target as a reactor. Certain indeed information was not given, but by and large, there is a consensus that most likely it was indeed a reactor. And yet, the silence continued in various kind of forms. So with this in mind, the questions that we started our work, kind of first conversation between us and then starting to write down various kind of notes, was first to try to examine in details what really is similar and what is different between the actions in 81 and 2007. In terms of the attacker, in terms of the attacked country, and in terms of the international community. Second, how to interpret the silence. What is the meaning of that silence? Is it a tacit endorsement or something else? And third, what does it mean about the important case which is at hand, the case of Iran? Most of my comments, I have only perhaps 5 minutes to talk, would be about the first item, that is to say, the historical difference and similarities between 81 and 2007. First, in regard to the attacker, the same one, Israel. Yes, the modus operandi had some obvious resemblance. One specific target was attacked in precision, and the target was destroyed, and yet there was, from the very beginning, some differences. In 1981, Israel, after 2 days of quasi-silence, in a moment I'll say something about that quasi-silence, acknowledged, Prime Minister Begin himself had a major press conference and some press interviews, in which not only acknowledged the actions and defended it, but he tried to provide, he said tried because actually there was quite confusion about it. He said certain technical things that were inaccurate, and some people said for her they were mirror images about Israel itself. But he was trying to defend and provide certain justification of why Israel attacked at that very point. So it was acknowledgement, there was defense, there was justification. The issue was on the table officially. And it was very important for Prime Minister Begin, who was very much the project's director, it was his project, to appear not as his language, he was using that phrase, not as a thief at night. Incidentally, the attack was at 5:30 in the afternoon on the 7th of June 1981, just before sunset. The attack this time, and I'll close my words at the end by talking about something about thieves at night, was somewhere between 2 and 3 in the morning, very much like thieves at night. Menachem Begin provides very strong moralistic arguments. He mentioned the Holocaust. He was referring to an Iraqi reactor as something that prepared another Holocaust. And he was talking in not only political but also in moralistic terms about the right of Israel to defend itself. He was talking about this was self-defense in its best modality, or phrases like that. This time, And by the way, one more important feature of the attack in 81, Israel did it alone. There was virtually, beyond a certain campaign, diplomatic campaign, that was trying to call attention to the Iraqi reactor from essentially 1976 until 79, 1980. But with the elections of Ronald Reagan and with the Reagan administrations, part of it was a result of some disconnect here between the material that Carter was supposed to provide to the Reagan administrations. There was very little effect, no really communication between Israel and the U.S. on this issue. This time, from all we know, there was a lot of communication between the U.S. and Israel. So first, there is a complete silence. Israel, this time, apparently did it alone, at least as far as consultation, assessment of intelligence materials, and a decision to act. I mean, the act itself was alone, but everything that preceded it was not alone. But the most important thing is the silence after that. No acknowledgement, no explanation, no putting the justification on the table, not trying to make a case. So that's about the attacker. I can note, just as an anecdote, that the Israeli original plan in 1981 was to follow the same kind of pattern, not to acknowledge. There was a consensus about it, even though the decision towards Iraq was a tough decision, decision that half of the political level, including Foreign Minister of Defense Ezra Weizmann, including Deputy Prime Minister Mr. Yigal Yadin, including the leader of the opposition Mr. Shimon Peres, all of them opposed. The head of the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission, Uzi Elam, opposed. The head of the Mossad opposed, and the head of the military intelligence opposed. By the way, for balance, their deputies, in two of the cases, the Mossad of the military intelligence, were in favor. So it was not a clear decision, but there was one person who pushed it, and that was Prime Minister Menachem Begin. So the initial idea was not to be quiet about it. Nevertheless, it was Begin who, for reasons of deterrence, for reasons all this moralistic, he wanted to put the issue on the table. Some people say it's also election considerations. The election were 2 months later, or 6 weeks later. So that's about the attacker, Israel. Now the attacked. In 81, Iraq was a declared and safeguarded facility under of an NPT state under IAEA. Iraq was viewed by the NPT system as this was a peaceful reactor by a country which was viewed at the time as in good standing. There was, you know, Israel made trying to make a case. But the Israeli case at the time was not a simple one. Osirak was not a reactor that could be designed or could be used to produce plutonium. You need to make certain modifications, and those modifications had to be made in such a way that the IAEA would not be able to detect it. So it was not a simple thing that could be used for weapons. You need to do a certain kind of work. If the CIA is correct about the facility, the reactor in Al-Kabir, it was duplication of North Korean reactor made to produce plutonium. So we're talking about facility which is 2007, which is undeclared, which is unsafeguarded, and of a country which is under the IAEA. If indeed the objective is correct of, as the CIA put it, it's directly for production of plutonium for what else if not weapons program. So there is quite a difference in terms of the being attacked. The country is being attacked. Another difference is, of course, the response. In 1981, when Iraq was attacked, it took them a few hours, perhaps a day. The first announcement came from Jordan, kind of unofficial rumor. And then when Menachem Begin went ballistic, when his press conference, Iraq on its own had a diplomatic offensive against Israel. We are NPT states. We are attacked by a country which itself is not part of the NPT, not only that, assumed to have nuclear weapons. And they went to all the bodies, international bodies in the world that can deal with it, Security Council, General Assembly, IAEA, everybody they could go to. So Iraq demanded sanctions, penalties, and the like on Israel. Of course, in the case of Syria, Syria said virtually nothing except, and even that after a few hours and after rumors spread, that its airspace has been violated. This was for 2 weeks. The Syrian response, and some kind of material was dropped. 2 weeks later, President Bashar Assad was saying something about some military facility has been attacked without giving any details. So Syria did not make any complaints except airspace being violated, which is interesting. Now, briefly about the international community. In 1981, of course, there was, as David mentioned, there was major repercussions all over. Israel condemned the Security Council. There was some 40 or so speeches in which all of them were condemned pretty badly in other bodies. This time, if you look at the variety of activities that took place, including prep of the NPT, IEA, various kind of meetings, of course, Security Council, there was complete silence. Now, one way to think about it is in terms of interpretation, I think that part of it is Israel learned part of its what happened in 81. And I think they realized that it's better not to present evidence and try to defend it, rather to let it go, given the fact that the other country is not going to make that kind of noise. That was quite obvious. I think the whole notion of trying to protect, defend, justify evidence is problematic. But I think the metaphor to think about it is there is a huge difference between attacking somebody who's supposedly peaceful at his own home on daytime, and then of course he can go to the police and anybody else, and attacking a criminal in the middle of the night while he is doing some actions that involve that crime without acknowledging anything. So there is a huge difference in terms of the way you put it to the international community. We do believe it's more than that, and I'll leave to my colleague, to Sandy, to say a bit more about in terms of the interpretation of what we think about the meaning of that silence. Thank you.
Thank you. Sandy.
Well, Avner and I, as co-authors, we may be doing a little overlapping in our remarks, but I'll try to avoid it. I would like to expand a little bit on the point that he made about what happened in the aftermath in the international community, because it was quite striking. It was not as if some odd forum had to be created to permit criticism of Israel. The fora were one right after another, immediately in the aftermath of the CIA revelations. The revelations came on the 24th of April. On the 25th of April, the UN Security Council was meeting, and it was considering a resolution regarding nonproliferation, specifically the extension of a committee to monitor the implementation of the Resolution 1540, whose purpose is to have states impose strict nonproliferation rules domestically and in terms of exports. So here's the Security Council, which had passed a very powerful condemnatory resolution in 1981. There's a meeting on nonproliferation. No one speaks on the issue. By the 28th of April, there was a major international meeting with all the members of the Nonproliferation Treaty represented. This was a two-week-long meeting in Vienna, if I recall, on the preparation for the extension, for the review of the Nonproliferation Treaty to take place in 2010. And this is a forum in which states speak their minds. And here was a setting in which, again, for 2 weeks, the matter was only raised by two countries, which were the United States and Canada, and they raised the issue of the attack, not the attack, but the fact that Syria was building a reactor for non-peaceful purposes and was violating the treaty, and that this needed to be taken very seriously. When we get to the IAEA, the Board of Governors meeting, this was another forum in which the Israelis had suffered back in 81. Here, Mohammed El-Baradei, the Director General of the IAEA, did express dismay that the matter had not been brought to the agency's attention. But again, that was it. There was the regular board meeting, it went on, and no further discussion of the matter. So this was not accidental silence. This was states seeming to very deliberately decide not to get involved in this matter. And so, especially when you look at some of the earlier situations, you do have to ask, what does this mean? Another factor which you would have thought would have stimulated enormous international comment was the Bush Doctrine. The Bush Doctrine was articulated in 2002 in the National Security Strategy, and it said the United States is prepared to attack preventively if weapons of mass destructions are involved, in a way well before the actual threat emerges, because the catastrophic consequences would be so severe if indeed we were to allow, let us say, an Al-Qaeda or some other state to acquire these weapons. And of course, this pronouncement in 2002 became the not so unspoken, the rather obvious sort of doctrine that underlay the eventual invasion of Iraq, which has certainly been criticized internationally. And yet again, when Israel actually implemented the doctrine and deviated from the classic international law interpretation of when you are allowed to use anticipatory self-defense, and that is only historically when you are at an imminent risk, and instead Israel adopted what was, in effect, the Bush Doctrine of acting well in advance of the time when the risk became concrete and was an immediate danger to Israel. Despite all the international attention to this topic, all the criticism of this doctrine, nothing. So these factors really sort of compounded one another and do ask, you know, lead one to try to figure out where we are. I think, and Avner and I, as we were writing, believe that one factor was not so much a condonation of an attack as much as a recognition that an alternative, or the alternative, of going to the IAEA and maybe to the UN Security Council was not such a great alternative. And I think there's a kind of unspoken debate here. I think this is what we really need to concentrate on together. Have we reached a point where the international community is taking the view, through its silence, that resort to the IAEA and the UN is not an effective way to enforce the non-proliferation rules? We tried to frame this rather carefully in our article, and I'm trying to do it again here. We're not advocating this as a good view or as a desirable view, but it seems to be the state of affairs, that there is this appreciation that where weapons of mass destruction are concerned, where you have these extremely suspicious circumstances, a clandestine reactor, a state that considers itself highly vulnerable, and I think Israel has this acute sense of vulnerability, you know, is it reasonable to imagine, and when you don't have an effective diplomatic remedy, is there a readiness of the international community to begin to tolerate some expansion of the classic doctrine of prevention and preemption? We also tried to explore what does this mean for a possible military strike against Iran, and we tried to be very clear. We did not think this was a green light. I mean, this is silence. So this is a kind of, I think it's the international community trying to recalibrate what its thinking is rather than an endorsement of what occurred. And certainly the Iranian case would be very different in terms of the military requirements of the job, whether you would actually destroy the capabilities that Iran might be assembling and so forth. So we think this is not the green light. The UN Security Council, in condemning Iran and demanding that it stop its nuclear activities of concern, has explicitly adopted these resolutions under Article 41 of the UN Charter, which says that military force will not be used to enforce these resolutions. So the Security Council is on record, I think, in this setting as opposing, at least for the moment, military force. Let me just close with a couple of comments on to highlight and reinforce a couple of points that David Albright made. David was stressing the pervasiveness of nuclear smuggling and trafficking. Well, that is certainly the case. This was a situation, it appears, where this entire enterprise began construction in 2001, and the bombing took place, the destruction of the reactor took place in 2007. And it appears there was no intervention along the way, no interdiction of cargo, for example, under the U.S. Proliferation Security Initiative. And at least until rather late in the game, my impression is, no good intelligence, either on the Israeli side or the U.S. side, as to what the Syrians were up to. So I reinforce David's concerns about this. Is there a nuclear weapon design that has been transferred to Syria now, so that we have not only the nuclear weapon design that was given by AQCON to Libya and perhaps Iran and North Korea, and perhaps a more advanced one that we've heard some discussion of, but now perhaps there's the North Korean weapon design, which is now in circulation. And finally, I'll just say the six-party talks are the six-party talks. They're making some progress, but we clearly aren't all the way home. And I'm not quite sure how much confidence one should take that these have eliminated North Korea's external activities, shall we call them, especially because many of these activities, I mean, there were North Koreans in Syria during the six-party talks. The construction was underway during the six-party talks. Equipment was being purchased under North Korean auspices for the Syrian project during the six-party talks. And there were undoubtedly exports directly from North Korea during the six-party talks. I hope these have all ceased, but we know that we are not all the way home yet in that environment, in that forum. And so I fear that we may still face some further challenges on the North Korean front once Syria kind of recovers from this attack. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandy. Next, Robin Wright. Your perspectives. Thank you.
Sandy asked me to look at the Middle East, the issue through the Middle East prism. And I, like everyone else, had my doubts when I first heard about it, and I was involved in reporting the story from a very early stage. I was convinced that initially that the Israelis were going after a Hezbollah arms shipment that was transiting through Syria on its way to Lebanon. This was at a time that the UN was increasingly concerned about Hezbollah rearming in the aftermath of the 2006 war. And it was only after I talked to a lot of people, including some I trust, that I was convinced that the U.S. really did believe there was a nuclear facility at this site. I've tried in the intervening months to look back at why Syria would have made what is a very unlikely decision, given the fact that it doesn't have the kind of cadre to build a nuclear program that a country like Iran does, for example. It just seemed a very expensive program for a country that also doesn't have the kind of resources that Iran does. And I think there were several factors that contributed to Syria's decision. One is that Hafez Assad, who was ultimately responsible for starting this program, his regional agenda was never peace with Israel. It was always parity with Israel. He always felt that Egypt and Jordan had caved in the short term, had settled short term in a way that would have left both countries vulnerable long term. His agenda came under faced a very serious setback in the 1980s when Israel invaded Lebanon. And in the first week of that invasion, Syria lost 86 of its warplanes and 20 SAM service-to-air missile batteries, which was a devastating loss for something that was the one element that may have at some point given Syria a little bit of parity with Israel. So parity overnight became a pipe dream. Then with the Soviet demise and the Cold War's end in the early 90s, Damascus would have felt, I think, particularly vulnerable. The entire region began looking more and more to the west, and Syria was increasingly the odd nation out. But then in the 1990s, Syria began to get a boost financially. It had new resources as it began to export oil it had discovered in 1984. And it's interesting that the first contacts, according to U.S. intelligence, between Syria and North Korea appear to have been in 1997. The first aerial photograph of Al-Kabar we have is from 2001. So that was clearly a critical period, and that's a moment, of course, when Syria had new resources. And clearly a nuclear capability or a nuclear program would have given Syria a new kind of parity with Israel. So on the second question of why was there so little reaction, I think that one of the things Sandy mentioned with the six-party talks over North Korea, they were at a critical stage. And I think one thing we don't take into account is how important this was to the Bush administration, where Iraq was in trouble, the Arab-Israeli peace process was kind of staggering along, that North Korea looked like it might be the one area where they could actually have something tangible to show by the end of the administration, and there was a desire not to do anything that might discombobulate that. What surprised me a little bit more was the fact that there wasn't more noise from China and Russia But again, both were deeply involved in the six-party talks, and that would have been a possible restraint on them as well. Second, I think neither Syria nor Israel wanted a war, wanted a confrontation. Remember, the September attack and the October revelations came just as the United States was trying again to get all parties together in Annapolis to revive the peace process. And there was a lot of movement at the time to try to get Syria an invitation to that. And the United States was the only one who was reluctant. Even the Israelis wanted the Syrians there. Third, neither the Syrians nor the North Koreans wanted a lot of publicity, which their own protests would have produced. They were basically caught red-handed. And my understanding is that there were a lot of North Koreans actually in Syria working on this program, helping construct it. And, you know, this would have exposed them even more. Fourth, Syria was on the outs in the Arab world. It didn't have many allies dating back to the assassination of Rafiq Hariri in Lebanon in 2005. Neither Saudi Arabia or Egypt, the two Arab powerhouses, were prepared to go to bat for Assad. Indeed, the potential of a Syrian nuclear program would have concerned them all, and they might have been secretly rather pleased that it was eliminated, particularly given Iran, their concern about Iran's program. And here we get into the discussion in the Middle East about the Sunni Shiite divide and the Sunni concern about the Shiite crescent. The one Muslim bomb, or Islamic bomb as it's called, was in Pakistan, run by a Sunni-dominated government. Suddenly you had with Iran and Syria the idea of a bomb in the hands of a Shiite country and a country ruled by a Shiite offshoot. And I think the final reason that there wasn't a lot of reaction was because there were still a lot of questions that hadn't been answered, and everyone was waiting for the moment that we could find out about fabrication plant, was there, you know, reprocessing facility and so forth. And my understanding is that there are three sites that the Western intelligence has asked the IAEA to look at. The third thing Sandy asked me to talk about was the impact on regional political and security dynamics. I think, you know, there's reason to be concerned. I don't think there's any reason yet to be hysterical. You could either look at the glass as half full in terms of dangers or half empty. When you look back at the news of Iraq's program in 1981, it does not seem to have spurred, you know, a huge amount of proliferation dangers, except maybe in Iran. Today, Syria's alleged program alone may not be the only factor in countries' calculations. Egypt reportedly had a nuclear weapons research program from 1954 to 1967, mainly in response to concern about what Israel was doing. Cairo reportedly went to the Soviet Union and to China in search of assistance in the 1960s, but was rebuffed. In 1998, long before Syria's program, Mubarak said Egypt would pursue a nuclear weapons program if necessary. He said acquiring material for nuclear weapons has become very easy and it can be bought. In 2005, the IAEA found that it found evidence of secret nuclear experiments in Egypt that could be used in a nuclear weapons program. Throughout the Middle East, I think there's also a growing appetite for nuclear energy, with the sense that oil at some point this century is going to run out, and the need to use their oil for export, for foreign exchange, not for domestic consumption. As in Iran, nuclear power is also seen as a key to development. So both, you know, past interest and current concerns about diversifying energy sources and economic assets, I think, lead to a growing interest in an array of nuclear projects that have the potential for misuse. One final thing on the issue of Iran. At the end of the day, I'm not sure that that the Israeli attack is going to have that much impact on Iran. Its calculations, both about its program and about how difficult a military strike would be, I think make it not as afraid as we would like it to be. if Iran has an active program, and there's still a lot of questions about what it's doing, I think it will persevere. I think it does not feel as deeply concerned about a strike right now, at least during the last 6 months of the Bush administration. I think it's keeping its options open. I think we've seen a lot of noise in the last week or two about the possibility of negotiations with the outside world. Clearly, this could be a stalling technique, maybe a little bit in response to what Israel did, but I don't think it's cowered by, or will be in the end, its decision will be based on Israel's strike on Syria.
Thank you, Robin. Fiona Simpson.
Let me know, by the way, if you can't hear me at the back, just wave or throw something. I tend to talk quite quietly. I'd like to start by noting the use of the term preventive in the title of this panel. As I'm sure you know, there's usually been a distinction made between preventive and preemptive war, with preventive referring to a situation in which the nature of a threat is still up for debate and is seen as eventual rather than imminent, and preemptive referring generally to an impending visible threat. And the National Security Strategy of 2002 argued that the term prevention should be extended to cover activities to address longer-term threats, whose exact form is still uncertain. The distinction between the two is still widely accepted. On the other hand, and as I'll flag up towards the end, the distinction poses some practical difficulties when it comes to addressing nuclear nonproliferation, which the case of the Israeli airstrike on Syria has pointed up. Before that, though, I'm just going to speak generally about the NPT and safeguards, the role and limitations that the Israeli raid has again highlighted. Of course, the regime is more than just the NPT, and it's more than just a collection of treaties and agreements. But the NPT is probably the best example of a treaty which codifies the broader norms of the regime. Actually, I Googled the words NPT and Cornerstone and got 357,000 hits, which gives you an idea of how often it's described that way. The NPT is viewed in this way because it is the agreement that defines and sets the standard of acceptable behavior in this area. It serves as a political and legal barrier to proliferation, and it provides for a practical barrier in requiring the conclusion of safeguards agreements with the IAEA by all non-nuclear weapons states party to the treaty. What it is not, and has never pretended to be, is a guarantee of non-proliferation, nor are safeguards and their related activities an ironclad guarantee of the same. And nor, it's worth noting, does the IAEA describe them as such. It's why the agency talks about safeguards as presenting or being able to provide credible assurance in this regard rather than incontrovertible proof. One should also always bear in mind that proliferation is in many ways a political problem, or rather the decision to pursue nuclear weapons option is often the product of regional insecurity, the desire for global influence, and other considerations that can't be addressed by the regime alone. As long as nuclear weapons are considered an effective means by which to obtain one's goals, attempted proliferation will occur, and in some cases, so too will unilateral action taken to prevent it. The NPT and safeguards can't stop a state from going down that road if it is determined to do so. They can forestall it, but they can't prevent it. How far a would-be proliferator will get down that road depends on any number of factors, but as long as a state considers nuclear weapons are in its interest, it can at least begin the journey. That doesn't mean that the NPT is obsolete, or that safeguards are ineffective, or that the regime has failed. But it does point to the need for a realistic understanding of its benefits and limitations and how to attempt to redress those limitations if possible. Safeguards, for instance, are carried out in an international system of sovereign states, and the IAEA is therefore limited in what it can do and where it can go. And this is particularly true in the case of Syria, where there's no additional protocol in place. Even in cases where an additional protocol is being applied, the IAEA is obliged not to implement it mechanistically. In a case such as Syria's, the agency could, in theory, call for special inspections, and the state could, in theory, refuse. And if the issue goes to the IAEA's Board of Governors, the state has the right to be afforded every reasonable opportunity to reassure the board. These rights exist because without them, states would not have agreed to the text of safeguards agreements in the first place. In the case of the NPT, Article 4 of the treaty reaffirms the right of states to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. In practice, this means that they can gain a technical proficiency that brings them very close to a proliferation option. And again, that article exists because without the reaffirmation of that right, many states would not have joined the treaty. In fact, there probably would not be a treaty. Nonetheless, there's an inbuilt flexibility in the regime that I think should not be overlooked. It's shown itself in the past to be adaptable in the face of various challenges. Currently, however, this adaptability has been hampered by the tenor of the debate over the last few years, which has tended to be mired in a non-proliferation versus disarmament standoff. So where does this leave us in terms of understanding the question of preventive war or preventive action in the context of nuclear non-proliferation? To my mind, it leaves us with the notion that meaningful enforcement of compliance through the regime is either lacking or perceived to be lacking or both, as is faith in the ability of the regime to detect violations. In theory, allegations of noncompliance can be investigated by the agency, and any violations of safeguards can be referred to the Board of Governors and to the UN Security Council. In practice, this doesn't appear to be proving effective. The case of Iraq post-1991 and the inspections that followed were the exception rather than the rule, although it pointed up the importance of an engaged and unified Security Council. In any case, the inspections in Iraq post-1991 weren't spurred by NPT noncompliance, but by Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. More recently, the ease of withdrawal from the NPT by the DPRK and the difficulty the Security Council has had in dealing with Iran have contributed to declining confidence in the ability of the regime to address these kinds of scenarios. On the other hand, it shouldn't be forgotten that the process of working out a more effective noncompliance mechanism would also require that the concerns of other states on disarmament for interest be addressed simultaneously and to their satisfaction. And I wish I could tell you how to do that. Still, military action, even preventive military action, may have a place in the regime. Frankly, if states parties to the NPT can't agree on improving the effectiveness of enforcement mechanisms, and if the UN Security Council is unable to agree on effective means by which to address these issues, then the fact of the matter is that this kind of thing is to be expected. That doesn't make it good or desirable. Even beyond the question of compliance with international law, there are practical problems with preventive military actions. For one thing, it isn't clear to me that they dissuade proliferators in the long term, either the state under attack or others who are inclined to follow the same path. It's also worth questioning whether, even assuming one was able to agree on a more effective noncompliance mechanism, that would therefore mean that Israel would not, for instance, have taken such a step. I suspect not. Raising the stakes such that noncompliance with or withdrawal from the NPT becomes an unattractive option is clearly necessary. However, one shouldn't assume that by doing so, the perceived need for preventive action, whether by Israel or another state, would be removed. It would, however, make such actions much more difficult to rationalize than they are presently. I began this talk by noting the distinction between the terms preemptive and preventive. I'd like to close with the challenge this poses in the context specifically of nuclear weapons development. By recalling that Oseraq was bombed prior to nuclear material being introduced into the facility, and that this was partly to avoid the effects of radiation contamination and to minimize the loss of life, both of which would have increased the damage to Israel's international standing more than it already had been. By the time a reactor is online and nuclear material has been introduced and more people are on site, an attack becomes more complicated, more difficult technically, and more destructive environmentally and physically. The very nature of the issue, in other words, lends itself to military action, any military action carried out being preventive rather than preemptive, in order both to achieve the short-term aim of destroying the target and to minimize the fallout, if you'll forgive the pun. The problem is that preventive action, by definition, means that the threat is still debatable, and as its legality, and as a consequence, so too is the justification for taking such an action. Thank you.
Thank you, Fiona. Last but not least, Ambassador Graham, if you could come up to the podium, please, that would be helpful.
Well, thank you for inviting me here, and I'm happy to be here at USIP once again. And being in the anchor position, I will just present a few sort of random thoughts, you might say, somewhat building on what others have said. Last September, in a surprise raid, Israeli fighter bombers destroyed a facility near Al-Kabir in Syria, which months later was disclosed to have been a nearly complete plutonium-producing nuclear reactor being built by Syria with North Korean help. No country except North Korea and Syria itself condemned the raid. In June, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, did say it was regrettable that force had been used before the IAEA could establish the facts, but he also noted that Syria, as a NPT non-nuclear weapon state party, did have an obligation to report the construction of a nuclear facility to the agency. However, a quarter of a century earlier, when Iraq destroyed the Osirik reactor being built for Iraq by France, this act was immediately denounced in the strongest terms by the Arab world, the United States, Great Britain, the United Nations Security Council, and the IAEA. What does all this tell us about the current state of the NPT regime? It is important to note the differences in situations presented in 1981 and 2007. Both Iraq, as has been said, and Syria were and are NPT non-nuclear weapons state parties covered by NPT safeguards and reporting requirements. However, while the Osirik reactor was destined to be part of Saddam Hussein's clandestine nuclear weapons program, it was a legitimate research reactor openly under construction by France and up to the time of its destruction consistent with Iraq's NPT obligations. The reactor under construction at Al-Kabir was not suited for either the production of electricity or nuclear research, and it was being built in secret, in clear violation of Syria's NPT obligations. Thus, on its face, the Israeli attack in 1981 appeared far more egregious, while the action in 2007 seemed more a legitimate defensive measure, even though Syria was judged likely to be years away from having any capability to construct nuclear weapons. This being said, however, does the Israeli raid in 2007 and the subsequent silence by the world community suggest that a precedent may be beginning to be established that when a state believes its neighbor is undertaking a potentially threatening action, which would be a violation of NPT obligations, that state can believe itself free to self-enforce its neighbor's NPT obligations? Has confidence in the NPT regime declined to the point where the procedures provided by the NPT regime, consideration of the case by the Board of Governors of the IAEA with possible resort to UN Chapter 7 measures imposed by the Security Council, are considered no longer relevant? The viability of the NPT regime indeed has declined significantly over the last decade. The basic bargain underlying the NPT, non-proliferation in exchange for peaceful cooperation and nuclear weapon disarmament by the NPT nuclear weapon states, largely has not been observed by the nuclear weapon states, most significantly by their failure to bring the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty into force. The NPT regime has done little to curb the nuclear weapon technology program in Iran. India, Pakistan, and Israel have flourishing nuclear weapon programs outside the treaty. And while the IAEA performed very well in dealing with the nuclear weapon program in North Korea, the progress toward a solution that has been made has come in negotiation outside the structure of the NPT regime. But it is important that the Israeli action not become a precedent in any way. If each NPT party is to be considered free to judge, and if it so chooses to act upon its conception of compliance with NPT obligations by other states, the rule of law entirely vanishes. Arguably, this could be said to be even a greater imperative in the case of a country such as Israel, which is not a NPT party. While one must recognize that the occasional extreme situation may perhaps call for an exception to be made, states should observe the NPT regime procedures for addressing suspected NPT violations if the rule of law is to prevail. This means proceeding through IAEA board consideration, UN Security Council consideration of sanctions, and in a truly threatening case, authorization of all necessary means by the Council to rectify a violation. It does not mean action by certain states as self-appointed NPT enforcers against the program in Iran or anywhere else unless all legal means have been exhausted and the danger is truly imminent. If the rule of law is to have a chance in this world of ours, the 2007 action by Israel must be seen as an aberration, not a precedent. And hopefully, the viability of the NPT regime can be restored in the coming years. But the future will tell the story.
All right. Well, thank you to all of our speakers for their robust and detailed comments. We have a lot of ideas, a lot of material perspectives on the table. It's now your turn, the audience, to fire your questions to the audience, and we're going to engage in a little bit further, more discussion. And as you do, I would just ask you to identify yourself, keep your question to a question, make it brief, and we'll do our best to briefly respond. And what you need to do, I think, if I'm correct, is if you could come up to the microphone. There's a microphone here over on the stage right, please. Go ahead.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. So far, the focus has been on the absence of an international reaction. But I don't understand why the world should react more than Syria. And what has puzzled me is that the Syrians did not protest, just the opposite. Since the bombing, we've learned there have been negotiations between Syria and Israel, with the Turks acting as intermediaries. We've had the recent meeting in Paris. So what's going on here? Why haven't the Syrians themselves reacted in a more severe manner?
All right, thank you. Robin or Avner, would you like to try to respond to that one?
I wish I could tell you authoritatively I knew the answer to that question. I've asked myself that question often as well. I think maybe they were caught red-handed. I think my understanding is that there are very few within the Syrian regime who were aware of the program. I mean, so closely held that top government officials in particularly pivotal positions did not know. Members of the family did not know. So, you know, you got denials, but it didn't go beyond that. I think Syria also, you know, as I said earlier, didn't want a war. I think that whether it was, I don't know the timing of when the talks with the Turks had begun, but clearly there had been overtures to try to get something started. They wanted to be part of the Annapolis process. There was a lot at stake there. I mean, what would have been wise for it to do? Militarily strike back? No. They weren't going to get anything at the internet. You know, they don't have the allies like Iraq did in 1980. You know, one and Iraq didn't get very far in 1981. It may have learned that, you know, seen that this was not something that was going to get it anywhere politically or diplomatically.
Right. Avner,
just to add a few notes. The possibility of war was taken very, very seriously in Israel. For months, there were Israeli divisions of reserves in the Golan Heights ready to take the possibility of Syrian reaction. So it was taken very, very seriously. One major reason, not the only one, for the Israeli blackout, and the blackout was unprecedented on information, was indeed to try to make it as soft as possible for the Syrians. So from Israeli perspective, the possibility of reaction was taken. It was viewed apparently as 50-50%. Now, I think that Robin is completely right. Apparently, even the air defense within the military, the Syrian military organization, was not aware of that construction. I mean, it was so classified and so compartmentalized that many elements, it was a gamble, I think, of Bashar Assad with the hope to get, you know, to get elements of nuclear programs ready, available in such a way that he is not going to be in danger of making purchases, which is, you know, purchasing is also the signature of activities, and it was a gamble. And I think that once the gamble was failed, and it was a sense that Israel is not going to allow that, there was a decision after perhaps some hesitation not to react. But I think don't think it was a simple decision.
The interesting thing was how quickly Syria moved to destroy what evidence there was.
That's right.
Right, I think David has another comment on this question.
Yeah, I think it's worse, actually. Syria's trying to beat the charges. And I've had meetings with Syrians where their whole intent is, you know, can we defeat the methods of the IAEA to detect evidence of a reactor? I mean, everyone knows about the graphite. I mean, if it should have been graphite and the reactor blows up, powder goes everywhere, and the IAEA should be able to detect it. But maybe not. Maybe the Syrians have cleaned it up so much. So I think they're actively trying to beat the charges, and they're looking for allies in that, too. But I would say there's a deeper problem, and that is that internationally, in the whole inspection process, the whole way the IA works, the whole way the Security Council works, there's no forgiveness mechanism. And we're facing that in Iran. I mean, Iran doesn't want to admit to things, and it's not just because they're hiding a nuclear weapons program. I mean, the intelligence community feels that that program stopped. But there's no way for them to come clean and not expect very severe penalties. Same thing is happening with North Korea. And these things are being reported on by the diplomats involved in the negotiations. So I think Syria also calculated that admission is only going to cause further trouble. And unless there's a mechanism to forgive what they've done, then why bother to admit, and why not just try to keep beating the charges?
All right. Next, please.
Andrew Pierre, Georgetown University. I thought that Stanley's question was very good, and the response is also very good, so I've sort of got a half question to follow up a little bit on it. And for Avner, could you say a bit about the extent to which internal Israeli politics had a role in this, in particular the difficulties of Prime Minister Olmert? And secondly, what lessons, if any, this was touched upon, but not totally, what lessons, if any, does this give us regarding internal Israeli thinking and politics with regard to the possibility of a attack upon Iran? And I'll just finish up with Robin. Perhaps, Robin, you could say a bit more about the Arab world in general. And the extent to which the silence, I hope that light off doesn't mean anything, the extent to which the silence within the Arab world, first of all, I guess the main question, given what you just said about Syria itself, is suggests that much of the Arab world in the Middle East may not even have known about the Syrian program. But let's assume that it woke up and it read the newspaper. Its own silence should probably tell us something about its attitude, Egypt, Jordan, others, towards the Syrian general, or maybe the Syrian program in particular.
Okay.
Yeah. Your two questions. First, about Israeli domestic politics. You know, this was done, including the whole process, and apparently the process of decision-making started sometimes in March or February 2007. So we talk about 5 months, and despite the blackout, it was quite effective. From the little rumors, the little gossip that went out, it appears that the decision-making process was relatively free of politics. It was deliberate. Olmert apparently learned a great deal of his admonitions by the Vinaigrette Committee, and he wanted that if something will go wrong, and if it's going to be some investigative looking at the decision-making process, it could be said that it was fair and deliberate. So apparently, many of the players actually, I mean, the early deliberation started with the time of Amir Peretz, the one before Ehud Barak as the Minister of Defense. So it took a while, and apparently there was a great consensus. Unlike the 81, that almost half the Begin cabinet was against the actions, including the major key players among the professionals, the head of the Mossad, military intelligence, and the Israeli Atomic Energy. In this time, apparently, this was not the case. Also, the blackout was quite effective. Now, the Israeli lessons. Well, one thing is that Israel still has adherence and respect the so-called the Begin Doctrine. But I think there is at the same time a recognition that the Begin Doctrine has limits. You can do it well militarily when it's focused on one point, it's relatively close to home, Syria, which was, you know, 300 kilometers or so, and it can be done effectively. It's a different story with Iran. And my own reading of what's going on right now with Iran, with all the noise, is that under Prime Minister Olmert, he is not rushing anywhere. All the noise, I think it's just a way to emphasize diplomatically that there is a need for action, more action than we have seen before. So I think also there was a sense of the Syrian dilemma. I think there was a sense in Israel that it was a gamble on the side of Bashar Assad. It was a way to tell him, look, in this area we are not going to allow you. We can do all kinds of other things we can negotiate, but on existential nuclear issue, this will not pass. And I think that message has been conveyed.
Robin, did you want to respond to this?
You know, the silence in the Arab world, I think that no one in the Arab world knew. I'm convinced. I think they were all shocked and probably in a state of disbelief for a while, and I think that not until the second pictures that David found of, you know, the site being leveled, you know, the bomb site, and then the site being leveled, there was a sense that the Syrians were trying to cover something up, and the fact they didn't try to take journalists, the international community, in to show them that this was, you know, a baby milk factory or whatever, to kind of seal the fate. The Syrians proved the case against themselves pretty definitively in the region, and as I said, I don't think any Arab country wants Syria to have a bomb.
Hi, Jonathan Geyer with the Middle East Research and Information Project. I'm just curious about implications for illicit trade worldwide. In the New Yorker, Seymour Hersh reported that it was unlikely that the boat said to have transferred these nuclear items was equipped to even carry such heavy equipment. And there's all sorts of gaps in the reporting on this. I was curious if Robin could please comment.
Yeah, maybe thank David you. And Robin.
David, it's better. I have only one thought.
Yeah, I think even though I don't think it was reported widely, that boat episode was dismissed pretty early in this whole thing. We certainly knew because it was a boat that circled the Mediterranean. I mean, it wasn't seen as a carrier of illicit products. The trade was as it developed, and Robin certainly got into this reporting very heavily, was that it wasn't like a country X selling a reactor to country Y. That it was done more subtly. The intelligence community had uncovered a shipment in a boat that went to the Al-Kabar reactor from North Korea. They didn't know what was inside it. You also had evidence of this company with the acronym NCG that was facilitating procurement. It had already been known to be a nuclear trafficker because of what it had done in Germany, and the people would have been identified. And then it was linked to Syria. And so you had this, and what does NCG do? They don't go and necessarily buy something in North Korea from their own people and sell it. They go and buy it in China, for example. It could be European. And a lot of things for this reactor are not very sophisticated. It's a very old reactor. It's not like building a light water reactor. Most of the components are not very distinctive. And so you can go out and buy these things. And so I think but these things should be detected, and there should be better mechanisms in place to detect these things, because early detection would have thwarted Syria. It just wouldn't have taken place if this detection had been caught in 2002, 2003, 2004.
Right. Well, if David, you've pointed out how you've spoken very clearly about what seems to have been going on. But the agency is now, International Atomic Energy Agency, is now investigating. David or Fiona, I mean, if you could comment briefly upon, I mean, based on what we know, what can we expect the agency to report to the Board of Governors at this stage? Are they going to be able to be
nearly that definitive, because after all, I mean, this is going to be the official record, the official findings of the agency in charge. What do you think they may be able to uncover?
Well, it's quite a quick answer, not much. Especially, and I'm assuming that the agency's access to locations is going to be fairly limited by the Syrians. That the agency's access to locations will be limited by the Syrians. And also, you know, there was no nuclear material introduced, therefore you're not going to find a sort of, if you take environmental samples, there wouldn't be a smoking gun, per se. I know, I understand, and I'm not a technical expert, so I'm sure David can speak to this much better than I can, but I mean, in theory, samples could find graphite, boron, and I understand that there's imaging techniques that could indicate construction, but none of which would be definitive proof of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I mean, a lot of it's going to depend on Syrian cooperation. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are these three sites. I told the Syrians about the three sites. I mean, I don't believe the intelligence is that great on these three sites. I wouldn't read into that there's proof that it's a fuel fabrication plant or a reprocessing plant. And just think of the case of Iraq, not up in the lead up to the war, but in the 90s, there were many suspect sites about secret activities in Iraq that turned out not to be that when the inspectors actually went there. So just remember, a site inspection is triggered by a suspicion that can be pretty minimal. And in some cases, it can be no more than throwing a dart into a board that has a map of a country. So I think we shouldn't read too much into that. But if we're going to get to the bottom of this, it's going to require Syrian cooperation. And that's not present right now. So we may end up in a long-term stalemate. Now, maybe the IAEA will come up with samples of graphite. I mean, the Syrians seem very cocky about that, if I can say. I mean, almost like they've done something so that we're not going to find graphite. And so, you know, wait the board report. But I fear that this could just reach another stalemate internationally.
Well, there is one more dimension. That's the Iranian dimension. There was already allegations in Der Spiegel and Guardians and so forth about some involvement of Iranians. If true, that means that we're talking about a multinational project with some sort of division of labor. Iran is also a member of the NPT with its own problems. So the story is could be also, if you have the full story, in principle, one can speculate, it could be damaging also to Iran as well. So there is more than one party who would like to keep the secret, more than two parties who would like to keep the secret of that enterprise. I mean, this is not like EhuCan, which we're talking about private network, primarily to some extent being motivated by funding money, by finance. So there is this aspect too is part of the whole secrecy of the affair.
All right.
Can I just add one thing about this Iran element? The Der Spiegel story I found a lot of holes in, and I would be fairly surprised if Iran had any significant role in this program. I would not even be surprised if Iran did not know about it.
The Israeli intelligence, apparently, from talking to journalists who may know, believes strongly that there was some Iranian involvement. To what extent?
In what way?
With some possible division of labor, perhaps the plutonium would be back up in some sort of division of labor between the nuclear project of the countries involved. And I think for North Korea, it was a way to keep some capabilities, particular knowledge, expertise, alive when you have to dismantle physical capabilities. So the story is far from being clear. I mean, there is a lot of element of the story which is still far from being clear.
Yeah, but these are, to be clear, these are reports in two news outlets. It's not clear what their sourcing is. There could be motives for leaks from certain parties to suggest that there's a connection with Iran that may not exist whatsoever. I mean, I personally find the suggestion of Iranian involvement incredible, in the sense that Iran has a rather active and advanced and controversial program already. I mean, this would invite a certain amount of other international concern and action that they certainly, I don't think, would want. But in any case, I think this is an unsettled area at best. We've got other questions. Yes, sir.
My name is Tamam Al-Barazi from Al-Watan Arabi magazine. How can, you know, the Arab country always repeat, even yesterday in the meeting in Paris, they call for a nuclear-free Middle East. If that's now becoming really a fantasy, I mean, how can it happen? And secondly, if Syria had this thing since 2001 and 2007, why nothing happened? I mean, there was no interdiction of any small piece. I mean, I thought, you know, United States always have these things like about this regime and that regime and this sanction. So what about other material besides the nuclear going there or to any country, I mean, in the area? What's the safeguarding, I mean, of United States? Let's forget about NPT and others.
All right. Sandy, do you want to talk a little bit about the putting this in the context of zones free of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons?
Well, this has been on the table for quite a long time. I think, Daryl, you may have said that at this meeting, or one of the comments we heard, in fact, Israel was present and subscribed to the long-term principle. I believe Israel has said it would support such a zone in the context of a comprehensive peace with other regional states. So, in a way, it's an invocation of a long-term desire, but I don't think it reflects, you know, tomorrow's policy. So I'm not sure that this particular reiteration of this general desire on the part of states in the region counts for too much. It's good to see it's stated again. It's a reflection of at least they can find a little common ground in terms of long-term principles, but I don't think it really amounts to a change in the status quo that's going to be seen any time soon.
Okay. Next question, please.
Leela Dane. I'm with the Institute for Victims of Trauma. I track issues from a more humanitarian perspective than policy. I've been very interested to hear the details of this panel. Thank you very much for an excellent job. I heard a lot about rule of law, our anchor man spoke of, and I would like the panelists to speak diversely on this issue of rule of law. One of the first things that I understood taking over the Institute 22 years ago was the attack on the USS Liberty traumatized generations of people, and there was talk about forgiveness. There was no talk about anything. It sounds like this is an instance that's very much like the USS Liberty.
So the question is, as I interpret what you're asking us to address, is was this from a legal perspective at least, a justifiable action by Israel or not? Do we want to clarify the views? I mean, some of you have spoken about this clearly, or do you want to rephrase the question and address the issue? Avner,
I think it's completely different from the case of Liberty. The Liberty was a mistake during wartime. Israel apologized, paid some money as compensation, and I think between the government, the case considered to be closed. Okay. It's true that there is a full mythology following it, to the best of my understanding of the case, and I read a little bit about it. I think the case is closed. It was a mistake during time of hostilities. Now, I think that Israel did learn some lesson from 81, and I think that primary lesson was we are not, the issue is too, has too many consequences to do it completely alone. And according to some reports, Americans were involved in the process from very early on in terms of the Bush administration, in the gathering of intelligence, in the assessment of the intelligence, and in the decision to act. I mean, Israel could not have acted alone to take the action if the U.S. would have objected to it. So I think that it makes a difference for a small country like Israel to take that kind of action alone as it did in 81, or with some kind of tacit cover from the United States as it did in 2007.
Others, Tom?
Well, it's difficult to make the argument that it's consistent with international law. There is no indication, at least as far as we know, that Syria was close to a nuclear weapon capability. The low confidence statement of the intelligence services makes that clear. It's to say that it's contrary to law does not say that it's not an action that is perhaps understandable. But as I said in my remarks, it's important, I think very important, that it be seen as a isolated aberration. If we move in the direction of establishing some kind of understanding under the NPT regime that anybody can do this, in particular the United States, but others as well, I mean, what kind of a treaty regime will we have? And the fact is, we won't have one. And I think if medium longer term, if the NPT is going to really work, then it's got to be respected. And of course, this action goes in the other direction. I don't think, in the grand scheme of things, this will be seen as some watershed event. I think it will remain as an isolated act, but consistent with international law, it is not.
Next question, sir.
My name is Faribors Frank Foladi. I run a company called Procurement USA Inc. As President Bush says, money trumps peace. So what we are trying to do to extend the goodness of Montgomery County in Maryland to Port of Baltimore, to Dubai, and after that to Afghanistan and Iraq and Palestine and Liberia. Now that I listen to this panel, preemptively or preventively, if Israel attack Iran, which Iran at this time making comments with is against existence of Israel, this was bad for the business. When I look at the proposal that was given to His Excellency Manuchehr Mottaki on June 12, 2008, for Iran to stop the enrichment of uranium, this is a very good proposal. I was wondering, especially Mrs. Wright, why the media is not publicizing this proposal to encourage the Iranian government to think twice about enriching uranium, and for the sake of peace, the whole thing will be good.
Robin, you have a thought about that issue?
No, I mean, the media has covered the two proposals on Iran, one by Iran and one by the world's major powers, the 5+1, the five Security Council members and Germany, to try to get it to give up its nuclear program.
Particularly about the proposal on June 12, 2008. I downloaded it from Mr. Spector's organization. I don't know. Can this be publicized? Can I give it to other media?
Do you know which one he's? I think we're having difficulty with the question because we may not know which document you're referring to.
I'm not certain what document you're speaking of, but if it's on our website, it's intended for public consumption. So.
So I encourage everybody to check it out.
All right. Well, that's an endorsement of the moderator. Yeah.
On Tom's intervention on the rule of law?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I think what we're seeing in these cases is international law tends to evolve from actions that, that occur historically. And I think the very point that Tom Graham makes is just the right one. This episode can be interpreted in different ways, and we want to veer it toward the aberration side and not see it become the norm. I think the best way to do this is to reinforce the effectiveness of the enforcement mechanisms of the classic enforcement mechanisms of the NPT, and that means really dealing with Iran effectively through the Security Council and through the IAEA. I mean, that's really what's at stake here, in a sense. So the Iranian case takes on, it's not only important in its own right, it's important in restoring the confidence of the international community that this is the way to go, so that the next time something like this happens, perhaps a state may be more exposed for taking the law into its own hands.
Yeah, another on this, Tom?
Yep. Yeah, I'd just like to expand a little bit on what Sandy just said. As I mentioned in my comment a moment ago, I think it's important that states respect the process set up in the NPT regime, going through the board and to the Security Council. But of course, that also places some degree of responsibility on those countries who are dominant in that process to act responsibly. If there's going to be nothing but vetoes, for example, on the Security Council for sanctions proposals, I'm not saying there always have been, but that there is the issue of veto, and that it, which means that the P5 have to be unanimous, and that is a problem in making this this process work correctly. So it's important that the procedures be observed. It's important that the states involved in judging the actions act responsibly and consistent with the system.
Yes, Howard.
Howard Moreland. every event like this I've attended seems to have at its base a fundamental assumption that Israel's right to own a nuclear arsenal will not be challenged. And it seems to me that a corollary to that would be that the NPT now is effectively an organization dedicated to preserving the Israeli nuclear monopoly in the Middle East. Is that true?
Well, I personally don't think it is the purpose of the NPT. I mean, the difficulty that, you know, we've dealt with, and Avner is perhaps the expert on this difficulty, is, I mean, how do you address and provide policy guidance, advice, and pressure on a government that hasn't acknowledged that it has this program? I mean, this is a problem that has existed for a long time. I don't think that the people in this panel accept the idea that the NPT is now designed or exists in order to justify or ignore one nation's nuclear weapons program outside of the treaty. Tom?
Me? Well, I mean, it's primarily the United. If you say that the NPT is a device to preserve Israel's nuclear program, it's primarily the United States that does that. Most other countries would like to see, over a long period of time, in any case, Israel move toward, in the direction of joining the NPT, and have said so many times. So the treaty regime as a whole certainly is not that. With respect to U.S. Policy, it's more complicated. Obviously, there's a very important domestic component that plays into this. But I've in the past, maybe it didn't mean anything, but in the past, I've certainly had conversations with Israeli leaders, including Ehud Barak, who said, "Sure, if you can convince us that there is no nuclear program in Iran and there won't be, and there is no, this is some years ago, there is no program in Iraq and there won't be, and there'll be inspections throughout the region, then Israel might consider joining nuclear weapon free zone or NPT." What have you, because after all, with their conventional forces, they would still have a very dominant position and be quite secure in their region. But obviously, we're a long way from that. So I don't think the treaty is that at all.
I'll respond very briefly also to what Howard asked. Look, I think that almost everybody understands that the NPT in its present form simply does not fit the Israeli situation of today in the Middle East today. So to try to put the two together, it just doesn't go anywhere. I happen, and actually even Tom and I at one point even wrote towards that, and I'm finishing now actually work book that calls for Israel to come to terms and to have a new bargain with the atom or with the bomb that will be different from the one that was struck many, many years ago, more than 40 years ago in 1969 between Richard Nixon and Golda Meir, which made the kind of situation which is awkward politically, domestically, and internationally, and it's uncomfortable situation. So I do think that it's good to try to think for the long terms for Israel to have a different bargain with the atom. But it's complex and it's a very complicated issue.
Can I just add one thing? I think certainly Howard reflects a feeling among many that the balance has come undone, that there should be pressure on Israel to limit its nuclear arsenal. I mean, there should be discussions of fissile material cutoff treaties, CTBTs, things like that that start to get Israel to engage in arms control / disarmament discussion. And in the last 8 years, those have just gone away. And I think that I hope in the next administration, whoever wins, that some of that is brought back in, because I think it is important that Israel engage on these issues internationally and start to see that if what Abner's talking about can come to pass, that it can start working toward elimination of nuclear weapons in its own country.
And that, I would say, it also applies to the other two states that have never signed the NPT. And for those of you who have been paying attention to the debate about the U.S.-India nuclear deal, I think some of the same things could be said about the wishes of some of us supporting the NPT and the non-proliferation system about what India needs to do to join the non-proliferation, begin to join the non-proliferation mainstream.
I'd like to comment on
this. Okay.
If you have a moment, I'd like to comment on that. I think actually, this may sound ridiculous, but I think actually in the long run, Israel is going to be an easier sell to the NPT than India is. Israel does not desire to be a great power. India does, and that's why it likes nuclear weapons. And so India would have to give up, in a sense, a lot more. It'd have to give up its aspirations, whereas Israel would just need to feel secure. And that's a tall order, but that's a little different. And I just want to say about the article that Avner and I wrote, I guess it was 4 years ago now, we were attacked vigorously by people supporting Israel and by arms controllers, so I'm sure you must have been right.
All right, we've got a brief amount of time for two questions. Please make a question, Diane.
Okay. Thank you. Diane Perlman. My question's about misperception, intelligence, fear, and escalation, and something that just came up on the panel had a little red flashing light for me, and that was the difference in opinion on intelligence from Der Spiegel, and that, you know, Rob and Daryl felt that Iran was not involved, and according to Israeli intelligence, they thought that there was an involvement, which reminded me that Olmert and Bush were dismissing the results of the NIE. And I think perception is more important than reality sometimes, and there's reacting out of fear. And I think there's still a concern about Israel attacking or colluding in attacking Iran, and some Israeli journalists that I spoke to felt, you know, gripped by fear and feeling that Iran was going to attack them. So
the question is,
make a comment about, I guess, intelligence misperception.
Well,
the differences. I mean, they're two completely different opinions.
Well, I think, you know, one of the implicit issues in this discussion is that, and I brought this up at the beginning, is that none of us sitting here along the table, not to my knowledge, has access to the classified information that the U.S. intelligence community has gathered on this event. I mean, we're working with a limited deck of cards. And I think that in our experience with North Korea, Iran, Iraq over the last few years, we all need to look first with a skeptical eye about intelligence assessments that are provided, but there are some things here that I think many of us would agree are pretty clear, which is that Syria was working on a reactor, and that alone has implications that we've been trying to address. So, I mean, there are, I think, disagreements perhaps about what we know beyond that, but on some things, I think our panel is fairly much in agreement on the basis. So let me go to the next question, and then I'm going to ask.
Can I just make one thing? Yep. I want to make sure you understand. I said I don't think that Iran had. I doubt that Iran had any significant role. You know, maybe there was something they knew about. It's a significant role. I'm not ruling out that they did nothing.
Right. That's a good clarification.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, J.K. Kim from Radio Free Asia. I would like to ask the panel's prospect. With Israel's airstriking, can we assume that Syria and North Korea's nuclear connection is done? And current six-party talk, can North Korea dismantle the North Korean's nuclear program?
David, do you want to address that and others, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it's an open, it's a legitimate question. But I think if you look at the briefing, what the intelligence community said, that they don't see any evidence of continued nuclear cooperation, or they didn't. They tried to raise it, and I can tell you, in the days leading up to the briefing, this was a hot topic and a hot controversy of what the briefing would say on this issue. But in the end, what it really talked about was perhaps North Koreans did some damage assessment, but that there was no evidence that could be found that nuclear cooperation continued after the bombing. And nuclear cooperation means the transfer of technology or equipment or parts. And so I think that always has to be verified. And North Korea is a proliferator. NCG wasn't just selling to Syria. And so you have to worry what North Korea is up to on illicit trade, because it likes to make money. North Korea did commit in a six-party process to stop this kind of proliferation. And so I think you have leverage on them, and certainly they're going to have to open up about their connection to Syria in the later phases. And everyone's going to have to be vigilant, because unfortunately, you know, it's not even because the North Koreans are bad. It's just a fundamental problem of capitalism. You start to find a way to make a lot of money easy, you like to keep doing it. and until you're put in jail, essentially, or actively stopped, you're going to probably continue to do it. Certainly one of the big lessons of the AQCON network.
There's money.
I guess trying to, as I commented when I was at the podium, there is this sort of history of cynicism and deception by the North Koreans, even during the six-party talks themselves. I think one just has to be cautious here. It's not clear that we're going to get resolution of the uranium enrichment question. That's still an outstanding issue. I guess it's hard to imagine that after the reactor was destroyed that they're going to be rushing new equipment into Syria anytime soon. But it's not clear as to when, you know, this might have stopped. And there was the comment by the intelligence community that the North Koreans did assist in the raising of the site. So I don't think they have such perfectly clean hands even after the raid. And in fact, as I remember, the reason that they were taken off the terrorism list when they were was because 6 months had to elapse after the raising of the reactor when it could be said they were no longer helping a state supporter of terrorism. So, you know, it may be that this is over, but I don't think it's a rock-solid situation. It's one that I think is, for example, you're going to have a missile connection undoubtedly continue between North Korea and Syria. So, you know, this is not, the nuclear dimension maybe is over, but other unfortunate aspects may be continuing, and who knows if Syria won't want to try to restart this at some point.
Right.
Yeah, one clarification. The briefing said damage assessment efforts, not raising. Is that?
I thought they were on the site. Well, all right, they were on the site at the time that these Syrians were raising the site. So it was after the raid. But anyway, I thought that was the... what is damage assessment? They were asking, the Syrians are saying, can we rebuild this thing, or is it gone?
Oh, but it's different than actively going in and blowing up things, taking away things. I mean, because there's an implication that somehow that they were, and this is what I would disagree with, that they're engaged in continuing the cooperation. And I would say that the evidence for that isn't there, and given what was going on in the North Six-Party talks and can happen later in the Six-Party talks, the North Koreans had a disincentive to do that. And again, I think, Robin, you reported this, right, that the NCG people left North Korea? I'm sorry, left Syria. Left Syria.
All I can say is we also did not observe them doing it beforehand. So, you know, our intelligence may not be perfect in that case.
That's right. And it has to be watched. And I think that it's very important to watch. And I don't think North Korean proliferation has stopped. So I think that it's important to keep pressing this issue.
So, David, well, can I ask you a question? Can I talk?
If it's very quick, yeah, but because we have to wrap up, Tom.
Okay. When you say North Korean proliferation has done, you mean within North Korea or elsewhere?
No, elsewhere. Selling, buying and selling for others, let's say. It's not clear at all that's stopped.
Well, as you can tell, there are many questions left behind, and I think and I hope that this is not the last public discussion of these issues. I want to just very briefly ask, and this is not a requirement, if anyone on the panel has any final thought, 30 seconds, that you don't think was communicated in the Q&A session before we adjourn. Hearing none.
Sure. Yeah, let me actually. I don't want to sound like an apologist for Syria, but I think we have to. I've heard several times today, maybe this won't be the last word, based on what I'm just going to say. But we've heard several times today that it was a plutonium production reactor, in a sense, single track toward nuclear weapons. I think that's what it was originally. But it's not clear to me that's what it became. Because the other part of it is, Syria would not be allowed to build a reactor. It actually tried to buy a reactor from Russia, like the one they're building, similar, a little different technology, and they couldn't get it. And so they may have, in the end, been presenting a reactor that would be used for civil research and possibly for electricity production. Because after all, these reactors are fine for electricity production and for doing certain types of research.
But why did they hide it, if that's the case?
Well, they weren't allowed, they're not allowed to build it.
And the story that
I
heard...
Even if it's civil, they would be stopped from building
That type of reactor.
Yeah. Any reactor.
Why? They can't build...
They wanted to buy a safeguarded reactor from Russia in the late 1990s.
Right.
And it was 25 megawatts thermal or so, and it was stopped under U.S. and Israeli pressure.
Oh, not under the treaty, not by the IAEA.
No. Yeah. But it's just that the idea that Syria having a reactor is against the norm established by the United States and Israel.
The story, actually, David, that I heard, the narrative was that the Syrians stopped their own probing elsewhere just by the time that they signed the deal with North Korea. In other words, it was kind of, that's it, we're going that direction, and therefore we're not looking for any more for the Russians or Indians.
Oh, because the North Koreans showed up.
David, I didn't fully understand that. You mean Washington is determining which countries can have reactors around the world?
Well, this is a rhetorical question, I think.
Yes, it is.
All right, well, I think we have run out of our allotted time. To paraphrase one of our most famous former Secretaries of Defense, there are a lot of known unknowns that we're going to continue to explore. I want to thank the audience for your attention, and please join me in thanking our panelists for the presentation.